VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, you will hear stories from Dan Novak and John Russell. Later, Gina Bennett answers a question about the word yet. We close the show by hearing part two of The Open Boat by Stephen Crane. But first...
In many movies, the clothing the actors wear is an important part of the story. In Rome, there is a workshop that has been a big part of Italian and international film history for 60 years. Tirelli Costumes in Rome's Prati neighborhood is an atelier, a business that makes special clothing and costumes. It has earned the nickname the Oscar Tailor's Shop for its work in film costume design. An Oscar is another name for an award from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Umberto Tirelli started the shop in November 1964. It has been behind 17 Academy Awards for Best Costume Design. Most recently, its workers helped create the costumes for Ridley Scott's movie, Napoleon. The film's costume designers were nominated for an Oscar that will be decided at the Academy Awards in Hollywood this weekend. Maybe it will win. Let's add another medal to the medal collection, the shop's current head, Dino Trapetti, told the Associated Press. Of course, the Oscar won by the tailor's shop, the Oscar is won by the costume designer. But the tailor's shop has the merit and the honor of having participated to make it win. The beginning of the atelier started with Tirelli's passion for collecting old clothes. He searched for clothing in houses of nobility and flea markets worldwide. He slowly built a collection that now has more than 15,000 real pieces of clothing that dates from 1750 to 1980. At the start, the shop had a sewing machine, two cutters, and two other seamstresses, Trapetti said. Today, the headquarters of Tirelli Costumes has mannequins wearing some of the atelier's most famous creations. A pink-flowered outfit that actor Tom Hulce wore as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in Amadeus, and the red outfit Michelle Pfeiffer wore in The Age of Innocence. The designers of each of those pieces of clothing won Oscars. After the 1984 costume design Oscar for Amadeus, Tirelli could have accepted many international projects because the market was immediately interested, Trapetti said. But Tirelli, who died in 1990, was not sure. Trapetti remembered him saying, "I'm not going to America. If America wants, America will come looking for me." Over 60 years, the tailor's shop has created more than 300,000 costumes that are now stored near Rome. Costume designers come for ideas and historical information. They also come for hand-cut, hand-sewn creations by the team of Tirelli workers. You can't make those costumes in a factory. In a factory, you can make films with robots, futuristic or fantasy, Trapetti said. But these things have to be made by hand. I'm Dan Novak.
Thank you.
Russia and China are considering putting a nuclear power station on the moon in about 10 years. The head of Russia's space agency Roscosmos, Yuri Borisov, made the statement recently. He added that such a project could support the building of moon settlements one day. Borisov said that Russia and China had been working on a moon program together. The former deputy defense minister explained that Russia was able to help with its expertise in nuclear space energy. "Today we are seriously considering a project. Somewhere at the turn of 2033 to 2035, to deliver and install a power unit on the lunar surface together with our Chinese colleagues," Borisov said. Solar panels would not be able to provide enough electricity to power future moon settlements, he said, while nuclear power could. He said the possible plan should be done without the presence of humans. Borisov also spoke about Russian plans to build a nuclear-powered spaceship to carry cargo. He said all the technical questions concerning the project had been solved, except for finding out how to cool the nuclear reactor. He said the ship would be a large structure that would be able, thanks to a nuclear reactor and high-power turbines, to transport large cargoes from one orbit to another. He added that such a ship could collect objects for many other projects. Russian officials have spoken before about plans to mine minerals on the moon, but the Russian space program has suffered a series of problems in recent years. Its first moon mission in 47 years failed last year after Russia's Luna 25 spacecraft lost control and crashed. Russian officials have said they will launch further lunar missions and then explore the possibility of a joint Russia-China crewed mission and even a lunar base. Last month, China said it aimed to put the first Chinese astronaut on the moon before 2030. Russian President Vladimir Putin last month said a warning by the United States that Russia planned to put nuclear weapons in space was false. Putin said the warning was part of a plan to force Russia into arms negotiations on the West's terms. I'm John Russell.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Al. Hi, hello. My name is Al from Indonesia. I am still not sure how to use the word yet in a sentence, positive or negative. Would you like to inform us more about that? Thank you very much. Thank you for writing, Al. We have talked about how to use the word yet in comparison to already and still in earlier Ask a Teacher articles. Now let's talk about yet by itself. Yet is almost always used as an adverb of time. It means from some time in the past until now. Yet is used in both positive and negative sentences. In spoken English, yet is often used in both yes or no questions. For example, have you heard from your boss yet? Did you finish your homework yet? We can ask these questions without yet. Why use it then? When we add yet to a question, we not only want to know if it happened, but we expect it to happen. And we want it to happen. We can use yet with negative questions too. For example, have you not heard from your boss yet? Have you not finished your homework yet? Using a negative question expresses an even stronger expectation or desire, almost disbelief, that something has not happened yet. Most statements with yet are negative, especially in informal spoken language. But you don't have to make a decision yet. We are not there yet. In these negative statements, yet expresses an expectation that it will happen at some point in the future. We hope this explanation has helped you, Al. Do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Gina Bennett.
That was Gina Bennett with this week's Ask a Teacher. Gina joins me now to talk more about the question and the answer she provided. Hi, Gina. It's good to talk with you.
Hi, Ashley.
In this week's program, you answered a question about using the word yet in positive or negative sentences.
Yes, many materials say that yet is used in negative sentences or sentences that have a word that means no or not.
And you say that yet is used in both positive and negative sentences.
Right. In spoken English, most statements with yet are used in a sentence that has a word that means no or not. But with yes-no questions, yet can be used with a question that has no or not, or in a question that doesn't have no or not.
What about the use of yet in common phrases in English?
There are two fixed phrases in English that use yet. One is negative and the other is positive.
I think I can think of one. Not yet.
Yes. Not yet is the negative fixed expression. Are we finished?
Not yet.
Exactly. We are still going. And yet is the positive fixed expression. And yet shows something is happening anyway, even if we don't expect or want it to. It's often used at the beginning of a thought.
I was so tired last night. And yet, I stayed up late just to get time to myself.
Perfect example.
Well, thanks for answering those questions, Gina.
Thanks for talking with me today, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
We continue the story of The Open Boat by Stephen Crane. As we told you last week, the story is based on true events. In 1896, Crane was traveling to Cuba as a newspaper reporter. On his way there, his ship sank in the Atlantic Ocean. Crane climbed into the last remaining small lifeboat. Three men got into the boat with him. They were the ship's captain, the cook, and a sailor named Billy. For 3 days, the men steered the tiny boat through high waves off the coast of Florida. At last, they saw land. Here is Shep O'Neill with the final part of the story.
A long stretch of coast lay before the eyes of the men. Slowly, the land rose up out of the mountainous sea. The men could see a small house against the sky. To the south, they could see a lighthouse. Tide, wind, and waves were pushing the lifeboat northward. The men thought someone on land would have seen the boat by now. "Well," said the captain, "I suppose we'll have to attempt to reach the shore ourselves. If we stay out here too long, none of us will have the strength left to swim after the boat sinks." So Billy the sailor turned the boat straight for the shore. "If we don't all get ashore," said the captain, "I suppose you fellows know where to send news of my death." The men then exchanged some information. There was a great deal of anger in them. They thought, "If I am going to be drowned, why in the name of the seven mad gods who rule the sea was I permitted to come this far and think about sand and trees?" The waves grew stronger. They seemed always just about to break and roll over the little boat. The coast was still far away. The sailor said, "Boys, the boat won't live 3 minutes more, and we're too far out to swim. Shall I take her to sea again, Captain?" "Yes, go ahead," said the captain. The sailor turned the boat and took her safely out to sea again. "It's funny those life-saving people haven't seen us," one of the men said. "Maybe they think we're out here for sport. Maybe they think we're fishing. Maybe they think we're fools." Once more the sailor rowed the boat, and then the reporter rowed. Suddenly they saw a man walking along the shore. The man stopped walking. He moved his hand in the air to wave at them. He saw them. Now he was running to the house. The captain tied a cloth to a stick and waved it. Now there was another man on the shore. The two men waved their hands in the air as if they were saying hello to the men in the boat. Now, what was that moving on the shore? It was a bus, a hotel bus. A man stood on the steps of the bus and waved his coat over his head. The man in the boat wondered what he wanted to say. Was he attempting to tell them something? Should they wait for help? Should they go north? Should they go south? The man waited and waited, but nothing happened. The sun began to go down. It got dark and cold. They could no longer see anyone on the beach. The sailor rowed. And then the reporter rowed. And then the sailor rowed again. They rowed and rowed through the long night. The land had disappeared, but they could hear the low sound of the waves hitting the shore. This was surely a quiet night. The cook finally spoke. "Billy, what kind of pie do you like best?" "Pie," said the sailor and the reporter angrily. "Don't talk about those things." "Well," said the cook, "I was just thinking about ham sandwiches and..." A night on the sea in an open boat is a long night. The sailor continued to row until his head fell forward and sleep overpowered him. Then he asked the reporter to row for a while. They exchanged places so the sailor could sleep in the bottom of the boat with the cook and the captain. The reporter thought that he was the one man afloat on all the oceans in the world. The wind had a sad voice as it came over the waves. Suddenly there was a long, loud, swishing sound behind the boat and a shining trail of silvery blue. It might have been made by a huge knife. Then there was another swish and another long flash of bluish light, this time alongside the boat. The reporter saw a huge fin speed like a shadow through the water, leaving a long glowing trail. The thing kept swimming near the boat. He noted its speed and power. The reporter wished the men would wake up. He did not want to be alone with the shark. The reporter thought as he rowed. He was angry that they had come so close to land and yet might still die at sea. Then he remembered a poem that he had learned as a child. It was a poem about a soldier of the French Foreign Legion. The soldier lay dying in Algiers. Just before he died, he cried out, "I shall never see my own, my native land." And now, many years after he had learned this poem, the reporter, for the first time, understood the sadness of the dying soldier. Hours passed. The reporter asked the sailor to take the oars so that he could rest. It seemed like only a brief period, but it was more than an hour later when the sailor returned the oars to the reporter. They both knew that only they could keep the boat from sinking, and so they rowed, hour after hour, through the night. When day came, the four men saw land again. But there were no people on the shore. A conference was held on the boat. "Well," said the captain, "if no help is coming, we might better try to reach the shore right away. If we stay out here much longer, we will be too weak to do anything for ourselves at all." The others agreed. They began to turn the boat toward the beach. The captain told them to be careful, that when the boat came near the beach, the waves would sink it. Then everyone should jump out of the boat and swim to the shore. As the boat came closer to land, the waves got bigger and more violent. At last, a large wave climbed into the air and fell on the small boat with great force. The boat turned over. As the men jumped into the sea, the water was like ice. The reporter was tired, but he swam toward the beach. He looked for his friends. He saw Billy the sailor in front of him, swimming strongly and quickly. The cook was near him. Behind, the captain held on to the overturned boat with his one good hand. Soon the reporter could swim no longer. A current was carrying him back out to sea. He thought, "Am I going to drown? Can it be possible?" But the current suddenly changed, and he was able to swim toward the shore. The captain called to him to swim to the boat and hold on. The reporter started to swim toward the boat. Then he saw a man running along the shore. He was quickly taking off his shoes and clothes. As the reporter got close to the boat, a large wave hit him and threw him into the air over the boat and far from it. When he tried to get up, he found that the water was not over his head, only halfway up his body, but he was so tired that he could not stand up. Each wave threw him down, and the current kept pulling him back to sea. Then he saw the man again jumping into the water. The man pulled the cook to the shore. Then he ran back into the water for the captain. But the captain waved him away and sent him to the reporter. The man seized the reporter's hand and pulled him to the beach. Then the man pointed to the water and cried, "What's that?" In the shallow water, face down, lay Billy the sailor. The reporter did not know all that happened after that. He fell on the sand as if dropped from a housetop. It seems that immediately the beach was filled with men with blankets, clothes, and whiskey. Women brought hot coffee. The people welcomed the men from the sea to the land. But a still and dripping shape was carried slowly up the beach. And the land's welcome for the sailor's body could only be its final resting place. When night came, the white waves moved in the moonlight. The wind brought the sound of the great sea's voice to the men on the shore.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.